Are the microphones?
Hello?
They will be. There you go.
All right. Okay, we'll just wait 1 minute. We're expecting Scott shortly, so why don't we just wait another minute, please? Okay, so we are going to convene the 22nd meeting of the Municipal Courts Task Force. This is May 25th, 2016, and we are in the legislative chambers of the Tompkins County, and we have here present. We have to my left Liz Thomas, Gwen Wilkinson, Mark Solomon, Glenn Galbraith, Jason Leifer, and myself, Ray Schlatter, the chair. We do expect momentarily Scott Miller, and I hope that Betty Poole will be joining us as well. I believe that would be it for the group of us. First of all, this evening, we intend to discuss pretty much the remainder of undiscussed items, and then try to get into the report in greater detail or greater analysis, and perhaps everybody will bring everyone up to date with respect to the work that each is doing. So before we get to that, though, do we have an approval of the May 11th minutes? They are before you.
Anybody?
Glenn moves. Do we have a second? Liz? Any discussion, changes, modifications of any sort? And by the way, I would remind all of you that, as is our custom, if anybody has any changes that they would like to submit to Joe within the next few days, feel free to do that, and he will incorporate those into, we're talking about typographicals and others. I have a few, and I'll provide that information to Joe. All right, otherwise, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? So the minutes are approved. This is now the public comment portion of the meeting, and we are have been fortunate over the past 22 sessions to have individuals appear and speak to us. I don't know if there's anybody here this evening who wishes to speak, but if there is, please address us briefly and on any topic that we have been discussing or anything else that you believe is relevant. All right, there's no public comment. In terms of the chair's report, I have circulated a current draft, and it's a very incomplete. It has lots of holes, and frankly, it hasn't. The section 4 hasn't even been written yet. But there have been. I've incorporated substantially the work that Scott has provided to us with respect to the mechanism for establishing a DWI part, and that's included in part. Section 3A. There have been a substantial number of changes to Scott's language, and Scott and I discussed this earlier briefly, and obviously everything that is in this document, everybody recognizes nobody has approved it, nobody has agreed necessarily to the language, but we are trying to piece together in a constructive and transparent way the results of our analysis and discussion. So that is before you. It was just sent to everyone by email at about 20 after 4 this afternoon, and I am obviously interested in any feedback in that regard. Secondly, I have already received some feedback, some corrections, which I have not included necessarily completely. I included one with respect to the Village of Lansing, and I appreciate Judge Howell's response on that particular score. But there is more, and I know that, and believe me, I have no pride of authorship. I'm quite happy to correct whatever mistakes are in this document and would invite people to scrutinize and submit. So that's it on the chair's report. Staff report?
Report.
No report there. So, with respect to the discussions, we have been going through the list that Glenn had prepared for us. I wanted to, and I've sent out an email earlier this week asking everyone to take a look at some lead material, which stands for Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion. These are projects that apparently are, one has been most recently adopted and is in the process of being implemented in Albany. Another, and the motto for that came out of Seattle and even before that out of England. So, pardon?
Santa Fe also.
And Santa Fe, okay. So. I would like to include that in our discussion today because I think it fits rather neatly into what appears to be the recognition of this group that our hands, under existing constitutional and statutory framework, our hands are somewhat tied to impose on municipalities by fiat changes in the system. That doesn't mean we can't recommend them, but it becomes very difficult to implement many, many changes. However, it seems to me that structurally, one thing that we can do is to figure out how to lessen the load and therefore the cost for the local municipalities in a variety of ways. One way is this push to establish a countywide DWI part in Supreme Court. That would eliminate all of the DWI and drug-related, in other words, all of the offenses under 1192, Article 31 of the VNT law. It would eliminate all of those from the local courts, including the city court. And that all could be done and handled in one place, in Supreme Court, using an acting Supreme Court justice, who, et cetera, et cetera. So that's all part of Scott's analysis. We'll discuss that later, if we have time. The second way, though, that we can lighten the load is by implementing something like this LEAD program. Because in essence, what we're trying to do is to divert from the system. In other words, these many kinds of low-level cases, if we can have them never enter the system in the first place, not only does it serve a useful purpose in terms of the defendants, clearly, but it also serves a societal purpose because it directly takes people in need to the services that are there without the need of going through the courts. And thirdly, of course, it unburdens the courts. So that's a second way of doing it. A third way, and using the same kind of analysis, is with youth court. A fourth way might be with mental health court, et cetera. So you can see that at the end of the day, that as we lessen the load in the town and village courts, there will be greater incentive for those municipalities to do on their own, voluntarily, within the constraints of the Constitution and statute, to shrink their courts, shrink them in terms of justices, shrink them in terms of staff, and perhaps ultimately consolidate with adjoining towns in manners in which you may have only one court serving both towns, that type of thing. So that's kind of where I see the direction of our report heading. Obviously, that's just my opinion, and I'm interested in other folks' comments. But why don't we start the discussion on the lead thing, because this is something that's somewhat new, and I want to make sure that we do discuss it, and then we can clean up on some of the other items.
It's, may I?
Yes, please.
It's an Mark. Intriguing, it comes to us a little late in the day.
Absolutely.
In terms of our charge, but it certainly is intriguing and sufficiently interesting to merit, in my view at least, our consideration, notwithstanding that it's May, and would have been nice to know about it in, say, October. In any event, my question about it, apart from cost, which it seems to me is very important, but my question about it is, what is our ability, what is the county's ability to implement such a program in light of existing statute?
And I would defer, I understand that two people here have been to a program to discuss this, I believe as recently as today. So, Gwen, can you answer?
Yes. When I first became aware of LEAD, when I was co-chairing the mayor's Municipal Drug Policy Committee, and more recently, I have traveled to Albany to speak with Chief Brendan Cox of the Albany PD. They recently implemented the LEAD program, but very recently, on April 1st of this year. The municipality that seems to have the most record and who has actually done a document entitled the LEAD program, 2 years in, lessons learned, what to do, what to not do. And I and many other members of the mayor's committee and now legislator Peter Stein has developed an interest in this. He traveled to Albany with me. And I have developed, if not expertise, certainly a lot of sort of disorganized knowledge in my head about this. The LEAD program would not require any statutory changes. The LEAD program is a program where at the front line, in the trenches, is simply a matter of a police officer exercising discretion to divert an individual pre-booking, an individual for whom probable cause to arrest exists. And that charge is written up, but the person can be diverted to the LEAD program. And what that looks like essentially is they're referred to a case manager, they do an assessment, there's a 30-day time limit on the assessment, but the ideal is 24 to 48 hours to get a needs assessment done, because this isn't a cookie cutter program, it's a program where services are offered and assessed with input from the actual would-be defendant and substance abuse evaluation. We're talking about services like housing, medical, substance abuse treatment, shelter, food, public assistance. These are mainly going to be people who are committing crimes driven by addiction. And in Santa Fe, they include prostitution in that mix, and certainly prostitution is a bigger and bigger issue here in Tompkins County, again, driven by people's addiction and then ultimately by the influence of people who are pimping out the prostitutes. But it also involves people whose substance abuse is driven by mental health issues, in other words, dual diagnosis. And it's a project that will have to be front-end loaded with organizational work, because the hierarchy, there's no king of LEAD. It's sort of guiding, governing, managing by committee. There is a large group of people involving, could be city and county officials, could be my office, certainly would be the police departments. You have to get buy-in from the police first. You must identify early on, who are your service providers? Who have you got? Peter and I and a few other people have identified something like 27 potential service providers, including everything from Catholic Charities to OAR to representatives of county and city government to CARS to Catholic Charities, a whole raft of service providers. Clearly, in Santa Fe, LEAD has been successful at reducing the number of people injected into the criminal justice system, which does affect the number of people injected into the county jail on a pre-trial basis. And it's, you know, maybe a little soon to say what effect it will have on recidivism over the long haul, but certainly it's way the hell better than what we're doing now. My judgment is that this is a very fruitful project to pursue now in the planning, get into the planning stages now, because the county legislature, at least the public safety committee, public safety passed the resolution for reentry. And this population, the reentry population, what I like to call the pre-entry population, has a lot of overlap. And I think that the time is right and ripe to use some of that energy and some of those resources, if we can, to start getting people in a room to talk about what it would look like, what it would look like in Tompkins County. I met this morning with the chief of police. I know that the sheriff and the undersheriff are on board. I have provided to the mayor and the chief of police operational guidelines promulgated by Albany that governs their running of the program, right down to case management forms, assessment forms, arrest forms. So this is something that we know a fair amount about, and now we need to get, it's very important that we get buy-in from the rank and file police officers, and Chief Barber is going to be addressing that in his shop.
Excuse me for interrupting. This has been very helpful. I don't want to suggest any critique of anything you've said. However, we need the police officers to agree and believe and accept and be willing to entertain and employ such a program. You don't mean to say that as a matter of law, their consent is somehow required. I'm still back at how this gets done as a matter of law. And I take it the principal party that must participate is you, the district attorney's office. Because someone is getting arrested, if I've understood you correctly, and it's a crime, whatever they've been seen doing, it's a crime, and all of that's going to be deferred for a period of time while it is determined what services they can use. And then at the other end of that process, I take it, and I didn't hear you speak to this, but I assume it's correct, that charge will go away if all goes well.
Well, Mark, I'm not even sure they get arrested. I think the whole idea is,
in the sense that they get brought to the police station.
They can get brought to the police station, but there is no record. There's no arrest. There's no booking.
I understand your concern with that issue.
They're taken into custody, but they're not arrested.
And the charge does go away. In fact, About the only thing that back in the communities that use the system is certain kinds of reoffending and a failure to engage with the assessment, the intent.
And are the services on the other end of the assessment?
Yeah, they work with people.
Okay.
They really work with people.
Okay, I interrupt. So, what you're telling us, I don't want to put words in your mouth, is that as a practical matter, the programs have to be in place first.
Yes.
Because if there are no programs, there's no place, no thing to which to direct such people who would otherwise be in the system.
Exactly.
Okay. But that as a legislative matter, there's nothing that, does the lead program have to be a county department?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. And just so you're aware, I just was at an event the other evening where somebody disclosed with knowledge that there are over 600 not-for-profits in Tompkins County. Over 600. And so there are plenty of services available. The question simply is trying to, I think,
break down the silos.
Break down the silos. And I think in this, it sounds like the critical thing is to find, is to have ready access to these evaluators or these service managers or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah,
how do they do
that? Case managers would come on board after the people that are going to sort of build the fundamental principles. You have to have parameters. Well, you don't have to, but I think it would be a little bit crazy not to. For example, in Albany, nobody who's convicted of murder or manslaughter is eligible for lead, even though this might be 2 years later and it might be a petty larceny. So they put some criteria that disqualify. On the other side, they sort of look for people whose criminal behavior is triggered by, you know, extreme poverty, drug addiction. Those are the main ones. People who are particularly drug addicted, because in Albany, you know, the drug deaths in New York were just getting so crazy out of hand that people started thinking we got to really try to hook people up with services, and this is a way to do it.
What kind of crimes, though? You've mentioned prostitution. Would petty larceny be considered?
Yep, all nonviolent misdemeanors. In Albany, actually, they allow criminal possession of controlled substance fifth, and that is a Class D felony. They allow that to be considered.
Some drug
all
felonies.
Violations.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, criminal possession of controlled substance seventh would be.
And what are the criteria respecting the criminal record of persons?
Again, the communities vary. I think Albany won't take anybody who's got a weapons charge in the last 10 years. I will make these documents available to all of you. Because it's something we talk about. This, we don't have to do what they did, but seeing the kinds of things they identified as qualifiers and disqualifiers, I think will be, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Gwen, what's your opinion on, as Mark said, we're hearing about this a little late, but just what our what this task force charge is and the work that we've done and what you're aware of as far as the likelihood of the county embracing LEAD and all the initial work that still needs to be done to even start the LEAD conversation.
Well, the conversation.
Well, where does that fit in with our task force? Do you feel like, just, yeah.
Well, I think that LEAD would directly speak to the issue of promoting efficiencies. It would streamline the justice court caseload. If we have the sheriff's department, think of all the petty larcenies that come out of the mall.
Sure.
And think how many of those are possibly divertible. If you think about all the petty larcenies downtown, a lot of those petty larcenies are thefts by people who are spending their money on heroin or meth. And so I think that we could, it's a bit of a bootstrap, but I think we could make the argument legitimately that in recommending that the LEAD program be seriously explored. I mean, we may not have time to get to the place where we're going to say, do this, do this. Personally, I think we should do it. I have seen enough of it. I've talked to enough people. I think it is a worthwhile endeavor, and I think it will lessen justice court caseloads, and I think it will lessen recidivism, or, yeah, it'll lower recidivism, and it'll be far fewer people in jail.
It wouldn't hurt to have this task force final report at least address that we're aware of LEAD, and the task force has talked about it, and that we endorse that program being examined and hopefully even instituted in Thomas County. This isn't the task force, though, to...
I know.
No.
There are other task forces that are just starting to work on that, so I don't want to get too distracted other than, you know, one or two pages.
Oh, we should chime in. Yeah. And I'm happy to write up some notes about this. But I think there's already been discussion. The mayor is already hoping for a county-city working group. The county has the Health and Human Services Committee has already that was more on heroin than on LEAD, but the county legislature is very aware of LEAD. The chair of the Public Safety Committee is very invested in the concept. So I think it's fair to say that if we just put the imprimatur of our group on the project, after I send you around the things that we have, and people are in agreement, I think it would be helpful.
Could you, the material that Joe circulated, I read through all of that, and it does talk about reducing recidivism by 58%, and it talks about cost savings, but it doesn't quantify any of that. Was there any quantifying done either in Albany or as a projection? But I mean as a projection. Or as an experience in Santa Fe or Seattle? Or
I could reach out. I don't have anything like what you're describing from Santa Fe. Brendan Cox has projected that based on their population, he doesn't think they'll have more than 30 or 40 people in the program at any one time. So I can figure that out against the population. I can call him up and ask him how he crunched those numbers. I remember Peter, after our meeting, was doodling with numbers based on our population. I don't know if, you know, there's direct correlation just to population. There may be other factors that we have to figure, but, you know, we came up with a smaller number.
Okay. I mean, the concept of truly avoiding entry into the criminal justice system is very appealing to me for the low level offenses that are more symptomatic of other deeper and frankly pressing problems in a person's life. It's, you know, it's akin to stealing the loaf of bread in order to feed your family kind of stuff. So, you know, you don't send people away for those kinds of offenses. You don't give them the stigma of a criminal conviction or even the arrest. You don't want that. And frankly, once we truly, the key in my view is the training for the police, because ultimately they're the ones who are going to make the call. They're the ones who are going to say simply, you know what, I can see a Bo Saw, for instance, just saying, you know what, this isn't, you know, I'm not going to arrest you, but I am going to call da-da-da, and he's going to, or she's going to meet with you, and you've got to meet with her within 24 hours, and I'm going to either check up on you, or, and if I don't hear back, then I am going to arrest you.
You don't file the charges, right?
Yeah.
Because you hold the charges.
Yeah.
Don't file?
Well, I don't even want him to have to write them up. I just want him to just, I mean, my point is, I want him to save time. I want him to not have to go back and type stuff up. All he has to do is take some notes.
He's going to have to put it in the spillman anyway. It's a police contact with a citizen.
Okay, so he does the police contact, but that's all he has to do. He doesn't have to spit out the accusatories, because...
But we're going to duke that one out.
We'll duke it out on that, but I agree with Scott. It isn't our job to design the program. I think our job is to determine whether this is a program that makes sense and put our imprimatur on
it. Well, I agree with that.
I would like us to go further than to suggest it's worthy of study. In light of the fact that it's been adopted in Albany, which is an enormously complex community, I think we ought to say that as best we can determine at this time, it is something we should do, or words to that effect. And then recommend further study and assistance to the task force charged with making it happen.
I've read a lot of the materials, and Susie had sent me a lot of materials as well. I certainly am very comfortable already saying we should have a LEAP program, no question about it.
Are there any downsides? Some of these have run for some time. Are there any major problems or impediments? I mean, otherwise, it seems like a win-win situation, but
yeah.
There must be something. Why has this happened before unless there's something holding it back?
There is an attitude about crime and criminals in this country that has prevailed, certainly, until very... Actually, even Eisenhower, but Nixon for sure. And we are a punitive society. That's what we do, way more than Europe. You know, all you have to do to realize that is go into our jails, go into our prisons, and then go into a prison in Norway. You know, our culture is you do wrong, you will be punished. And when you combine that with some of the political expediencies and pressures that were put on Richard Nixon in the early, in his second campaign, all the money, millions and millions of dollars that was earmarked for treatment went for enforcement. And we first heard the words, the war on drugs. And we started to hear the code words, the people in New York City. And all of a sudden, we started to see a huge disparity in the racial composition of communities and the racial composition of the jails. And then read Michelle Alexander's book, read the new Jim Crow, look up some of the footnotes, and you begin to see that this is not the unintended collateral consequence of a genuine, authentic, sincere effort to save the country. This was the intended consequence of putting people of color in jail. Something that comes hard to me at this stage in my career, you know, all of us prosecutors have certain views about how things have gotten to be the way they are. And now, you know, now that the culture is changing around the stigma of arrest, now that the culture is changing where an arrest is actually seen as a type of violence perpetrated on an individual, well, if that individual's killing somebody, it's okay with me if we get a little violent with them. But we have criminalized an entire segment of society who essentially are suffering from an illness. And the illness itself is not born out of criminal tendencies or racial deficiencies. It's born out of isolation. It's born out of distress, poverty. It's born out of hopelessness at lack of opportunity. It's gotten pretty clear, folks. It's gotten pretty clear. And I think that the reason it hasn't caught on before now is because the culture around crime and criminals was really, really very different. You know, we came from the Puritans. We're a perfect example of the wrong lesson learned. You know, our ancestors came here, some of them, to escape religious persecution and immediately started religiously persecuting everybody else. And it's been downhill since then. Okay. I'm done ranting.
That's fair.
Liz?
I'll just add in that it seems to me, even though it's come late to us, it's a very valuable, I mean, thank goodness that it came to us. I think I have no experience with this, but from what you're saying, it's something worthy of recommendation. And again, I'll just reiterate what you've already said, is that it's not our job to set this whole thing up. It's our job to make a recommendation. And so if it seems like to those of you who are in the justice system that this is a good recommendation, then I wouldn't hesitate to put that in the report.
Okay. And Glenn, do you agree? And Jason as well? All right, so it's unanimous. We're going to put it in the report. But Gwen, please circulate what you can.
I'll do it quickly.
And then we can. And candidly, if you want to write up a little piece that we can just, you'll when you go to the report, you'll see that I actually have a
space.
A space for it, I said, if the task force agrees. So you can, if you want to take a shot at just writing up something.
Sure, just like a page or two. A
couple of paragraphs, yeah.
Oh, even better, because yeah. What I don't want to do at this stage, you know, we're on a little bit of thin ice with things, and I don't want people to feel like anything's getting set in stone. I want to put the concept out there. I'll write it up. You guys will look at it. You'll tell me if you want more or less.
Just say good things about it.
I'm gonna.
Okay, good. All right. So let's go back to the list. And actually, before we do that, I would like to, because I think we do need to have a discussion about this, I would like to discuss Scott's work and some of the issues that are outstanding that still need to be kind of thrashed out. So why don't I turn this over to Scott briefly, and you can, you all have it, but go ahead and describe what you found.
This could have been a lot longer discussing the different differences in jurisdiction between Supreme Court, County Court, District Courts, City Courts. I did the best I could to try to put this in somewhat lay terms of how this could work, but I failed in my attempt at that, because it's very procedure laden still. It is possible to create a misdemeanor DWI court without any involvement from the state assembly, the state senate, and the governor. The statutory scheme already exists, and judiciary law, maybe 211, I don't have it memorized. Back in the early 2000s, the Chief Judge Kaye came up with the idea of integrated domestic violence courts, IDV courts, as we have them. I don't know if they're in every county, but we have one in Tompkins County presided over. Well, that's a unique procedural situation of how that's happening. Essentially, an IDV court takes misdemeanor domestic violence cases, an assault third, a harassment second, it could be a non-misdemeanor, it could be a violation, a menacing that, say, is pending in Judge Galbraith's court or maybe in Lansing court. So we have a town judge involved. Now, if that domestic violence criminal case involves a family court case, such as a custody or visitation case, you'd have another judge involved. And if that involved a divorce case, you'd have another judge involved. So it made sense, and I think Judge Raleigh spoke early on in our meetings about how well the integrated domestic violence court model works. And essentially, you know, over at City Court, when we have misdemeanor domestic violence cases, if there's a family court component, we merely get an order signed by a Supreme Court judge. Judge Cassidy is the acting Supreme Court judge right now. I think we have a visiting judge, Judge Rich, who's also acting Supreme Court. But that's all it takes. No legislation, no motions. It's a sua sponte order. The local court, the city court, is merely informed that the integrated domestic violence court wants this case. Here's the signed order from the acting Supreme Court judge, Judge Cassidy. The case is gone. It leaves the local court, and it's now in front of a lawyer judge, a Supreme Court judge, who will hear the visitation cases, the custody cases, the matrimonial divorce cases, the child support cases, and the criminal case. And the beautiful part, from a district attorney's point of view, is you don't have to seek an indictment for a misdemeanor, which is that's a pretty extensive use of resources to bring a case to a superior court, a county or a Supreme Court, to have to indict a misdemeanor. It just isn't possible to do. And there's something else called superior court informations that's in my my section. But no one was really sure whether that was legal, this IDB court, whether it was legal to bypass indictments for misdemeanors and just bring them over to a Supreme Court. Well, the New York Court of Appeals, in a case People versus Correa, lo and behold, they decided the procedure that they, their chief judge had used to administratively create a different court part, that was constitutional under the New York State Constitution. Is it a bit of a stretch? Yeah. But it boils down to this. The same exact administrative procedure can be utilized to create a comprehensive DWI part. And our former chief judge, Judge Littman, 2 years ago in his State of the Judiciary said, this is important. Comprehensive DWI parts are important. Create them. Well, we've created them. We created them in county courts and in city courts. And there were behind the scene discussions about, wait a second, if this is so important, don't we have a lot of DWI cases in local courts? And shouldn't they be part of the comprehensive DWI parts? And I think, well, the answer is yes, but it just isn't politically possible to do it. And all those cases are just going to be left to the different town justices. And those defendants are going to be left out of benefiting from a comprehensive DWI part. But without town and village referendums, without a county referendum, without having to ask the state to change the law, the Court of Appeals said yes. If the chief judge, who currently is, oh my goodness, what's our new chief judge's name?
DeFiore.
Right. If the chief judge, after consultation with the chief administrative judge, which is the second in command, and after consultation with the Court of Appeals and some administrative body, promulgates an administrative regulation to create a part, that is legal. And all of the misdemeanor DWIs could leave local town and village courts, city court accepted because we have a DWI part, but they could then be brought to a superior court. That superior court does have to be a Supreme Court because of a jurisdictional issue that arises with Criminal Procedure Law 210.05. County courts, although they're higher courts, they're superior courts, county courts cannot hear misdemeanors unless there's an indictment. It's only because the Court of Appeals says, well, Supreme Court is a little different than county court, and there's some language in the Constitution that talks about Supreme Courts being courts of general and original jurisdiction. Therefore, that bypasses all specific procedures. They can hear any case without any special procedure other than felonies that always have to be indicted, because that's in the New York State Constitution too. Felonies always have to be indicted, or superior court information.
And also, isn't that right, Scott, that a county court judge can't handle a divorce?
Cannot handle a divorce, you're correct. But Supreme Court, however, can handle misdemeanors with a mere administrative transfer without having to go through a Superior Court information, without having to go through an indictment. So it's possible. Now, in my opinion, that's what should be recommended, pursuing that. Ray, you mentioned to me something interesting, that Tompkins County,
right? Yeah.
Caseload-wise, is, and that's maybe a pivot back to you.
Right. What we discussed, and I mentioned this at the last meeting as well, when they were doling out judgeships countywide, you know, from county to county. Chemung County, this was back in the 60s, I believe, Chemung County ended up with three judges because their population at that time was substantially greater than it is now. Tompkins County was given two county judges because our population was significantly less than it is now. The tables have been, the roles have been reversed. We currently now have more population than Chemung County, and yet we still have the two judges, and Chemung County still has the three judges. So an argument could be made, independent of this task force work and the creation of this part, an argument could be made that in fact we are entitled to, and perhaps at the expense of Chemung County, but we are entitled to a third county judge. We have the language that I've been working with after I got Scott's material is trying to figure out how to make this all cost effective, and because that's part of our charge, and truly in a genuine sort of way. And what I see is, and Joe had done some work in researching the cost, it's going to cost about $650,000 to add another judge and support staff per year. So the question is, where do we get that money? Or where do we shift resources to reflect that this is cost neutral? One of those pieces, and I'll just give this by way of example, one of those pieces is for clerk time. But the fact is that if we are able to shift all of the, and I'm not picking on city court, but I'm giving it because it's an easy one, if we are able to shift all of the city court cases, the DWI cases, into this DWI part, then we no longer have to have a DWI part in city court, and the staff in city court, who are all OCA, you know, they're employees of the state of New York through OCA, right? They can just as easily work for the Supreme Court, this acting Supreme Court part, as they can for the city court. And so theoretically, you could almost envision this DWI part being housed, in other words, the actual court itself happening in the city court facility. You can almost envision the clerk staff being the existing city clerk staff. You can almost envision the question of where the chambers would be for this county judge. I don't know. We'd have to figure that one out. But some of those costs, those $650,000 in costs, could be countered by the savings in some of the local courts. And I'm picking on the city court now as one example. So that's one area. The second area that Joe suggested is the very obvious area, and that is that currently we generate in the entirety of our county, I think it's upwards of about $1.3 million in fines from all vehicle and traffic cases, much of which comes from DWI-type cases. Of that amount, the state sweeps away about 900,000 of that, 950,000. And so it would certainly be a fair argument that we should get some of that money back in order to fund what should be our third judge in any event. So, but these are arguments. They're not going to be very persuasive when people have to write checks, and you can't write a check on a bank account filled with argument. So we need to figure out a way to actually show dollars and cents savings, and we can show them in dribs and drabs in other parts of this project. We can show them, for instance, in savings with the assigned counsel program. We can show them in savings with law enforcement, perhaps. We can show them in savings in the district attorney's office. I mean, there may be other ways to realize savings that can be reflected in this equation. But one of the issues I wanted to discuss today is whether we are prepared as a group, you know, notwithstanding our best efforts, are we prepared as a group to say this might be one of those changes or one of those recommendations that will not be cost neutral, that it may actually cost locally more money, but that the upside, which is even justice and fairness and you know, better services and all that kind of stuff, that the upside may be worth it. So that's part of the discussion I'd like to open up. Glenn.
Just a question. The $650,000, that was state money, wasn't it?
Yes.
Right.
So that would shift.
Not costing us anything.
Right. So if another county court judge was created, that would be an OCA cost. So that would be a state cost. I mean, it's still money, but it would be on the state's ticket, not ours.
That's true. But you're right. Locally,
we probably have to pay for a courtroom and facilities.
No, that's actually a good point. I mean, I'm just looking at this in the universal sort of way. You know, there's an extra cost, and can we save it somewhere else? If we're satisfied that it's a state problem, then I'm okay with that, but
but of course, it's not us that has to be convinced. It's
exactly.
Probably the state.
Exactly. So I think we need to be a little bit realistic about that.
Right.
Before reaching the merits of the question you pose, because no matter what the answer on cost is, the question remains, are we endorsing it in either event? I have a question. Is there, back to our LEAD, LEDD, whatever it is, LEAD.
LEAD.
Discussion, is there any intersection between LEAD and a misdemeanor DWI program?
I don't see where.
I mean,
well, kid is picked up driving on a junior license. He's intoxicated. It's at worst a misdemeanor, right? Why isn't that eligible for diversion?
Because you wipe out the predicate offense, and if he does it again, it's a better.
Okay, but that's true, Gwen. You're the captive of your own logic.
No, but
that's,
I hear you.
That's true of any event.
No, it's no. We're not talking about, you can have a criminal possession controlled substance 7th, and the second time you have it, it's still a criminal possession of a controlled substance 7th.
I understand that. But as a practical matter, the fact of the prior conviction is instrumental and often dispositive of what will happen with the kid the second time.
No, but I think, though, that...
Is there something... Wait, excuse me.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
Your point was that a huge component of the case for diversion arises out of the relationship between underlying pathology versus some kind of mens rea.
No, you're
crime
right.
Of intention.
You're right.
And the 17-year-old who's had 3 beers may be altogether as driven by substance abuse problems and pathology in the household as anybody else who's picked up at the mall in Lansing with a petty larceny.
I think that's true, but there are certain crimes that are not going to go into diversion, LED.
Why not?
LED. Because they're violence. And drunk driving is more akin to attempted violence, may not be intentional violence.
Well, the idea
and
is
the impact can be so much more dramatic than somebody who's spray painting, you know, people's mailboxes or something. And I think it's just a really tough sell to be providing diversion to people who are putting lives at real risk. And I think that's the difference.
Well, and there's also the point about driving a car. This isn't about somebody who feels compelled to drink. This is about somebody who drinks. And
oh, right, yeah. We're not talking about the open containers
or the
loud parties. We're talking about getting
that
behind the wheel of a 2-ton
but
vehicle.
I have to say, I mean, Mark, you obviously have a point, and, you know, I'm kind of hoist on my own petard here, but I need to think about it a little more.
Well,
but there's also an element of just this, what the state legislature set up, because DWIs are not part of the diversion scheme, or we'll talk about like what we use for felony and drug court, while someone who has a DWI can get into that program. It's not through the diversion process in terms of our 12.
Well, that's true, because I won't agree to dismiss the predicate.
But
they've already been singled out by our chief judge and our high court as DWIs are something different to be set off, not grouped in with other offenses. So there is another argument of why they shouldn't be in the LEAD program.
Well, and I think the other point, Mark, I mean, your point is well made from a consistency standpoint. You're absolutely right. We're not always consistent in every application of the law. And in this particular instance, if you're looking for a rationale to carve it out, the rationale would be it's no different than if you had a drunk person or a person on drugs pick up a gun and shoot it. we would say to that individual, we're not going to put you in the LEAD program. You're too dangerous to other people.
I'm always willing to be inconsistent in the interests of expediency, sure. Ray. It's okay.
Okay. But you can understand that. I mean, I think if you, the gun analogy might be the way, because it's the car is the equivalent of a gun, which is equivalent to the instrument
except
of
nobody,
violence.
Nobody loses their gun and then can't work because they can't get to a job. But put it aside. I've asked a question that's been answered temporarily.
All right. Let's go back, though, because I do want to discuss the question of the finance issue. Are we as a group prepared to, I mean, we can write this in a way that says this is a state expense, but, you know, candidly, part of our sell is going to be able to establish for those who make that decision, which is not us, it would be at the state. Part of the sell is going to be that we are, yeah.
You gave me a really good argument.
Lean forward, Scott, because
I'm sorry. You had suggested the following about how to present cost savings with the creation of a county court judge, and maybe we should add that. Well, I thought we were talking about a DWI part. It doesn't have to be a Supreme Court judge. We're not going to get another Supreme Court judge seat. Whether we get another county court, that's certainly aspirational. Maybe is that possible? Getting a Supreme Court judge seat is out of the question because that's not countywide. That's six judicial district. We need to focus on our county. And a county court judge, after having served for 2 years, can become an acting Supreme Court judge. So that's why we're focused on county court. Plus, our county court judges already have an incredibly heavy caseload, and we've been overdue for a county court judge, another seat, for a decade. You had argued the following, which I thought, that's a pretty good argument, although you've mentored me for so many years, I've been convinced by many of your arguments, and then a couple months later, in the silence of night, thought, well, gee, I think I do have a response to that now, but it's always been too late.
I'm interested in the argument.
We heard from a lot of town justices, and we heard a majority of them say, you know, these DWIs are the paperwork, they're confusing. If there's any case we'd like to get rid of, DWI, and a majority of the town and village courts seem to indicate that would make their courts more efficient, and it would help them concentrate on the shoplifting and the assaults and the family arguments. They needed help. You had suggested that maybe a DWI part, and there's 2/3 of the DWIs are town and village court cases. And I'll check on Freeville and Judge Galbraith's court as well to make sure those numbers are in there with Stop DWI. But that could possibly prompt the consolidation we were talking about. Do we need two town or village justices in each court now that there's no longer those complicated, time-consuming DWI cases? Can we start talking about consolidation of town and of towns and villages of a shared town village judge that could be from one judge from a contiguous town. And I thought that's a very powerful argument if we're trying to come up with cost savings and efficiencies.
Well, I think what you're reminding me of is what I had started out with here earlier, which is that the more we shift cases out of the local courts into these other processes, the more reasonable it will appear to the local municipalities within the constraints of their own current existing constitutional and statutory frameworks to make the changes that would appear to be more compelling, and such as, for instance, going from one judge to or two judges to one, or in the long term perhaps consolidating local courts. That fits into the rubric that is the drumbeat out of Albany right now anyways, which is to consolidate and combine, and that is, so in that sense, it becomes a good political argument for not just the equitable argument that we are arguing that we're entitled to a third judge, but the political argument is this is a good way of shrinking you know, and consolidating and making those fundamental changes that you're looking for. So yes, Scott, that, I mean, that, I agree with you about that, and I think...
Well, that was your argument.
That's probably why I agree, so...
I'd like to register my vote on the question you posed, Ray, which is... Let me state it this way. Do I favor the creation of such a court, notwithstanding the possibility that it is not cost neutral? And my answer is yes. I hope it's cost neutral. I suspect it will be cost neutral. I suspect that the savings you and Scott have just been discussing are available. I suspect there are other savings available that will be expedited and made more significant. That's the technological question, if DWI cases are shifted. But at the end of the day, no matter what the answer is to the financial question, compelling arguments were made before us by one sitting county court judge, by representatives of the defense bar, by the late Wesley McDermott, that it was critically important on equitable and justice grounds to divest from the justice courts at least those cases most consequential in the lives of defendants who were not being tried by, heard by, a lawyer judge. And on those grounds, and I give it, that's a very short statement of the problem, on those grounds, it seems to me that the DWI court is a very good idea. There are few crimes, the consequences of which are more draconian in the lives of ordinary people, working people, poor people, than DWIs and drug-related offenses. If we cannot divert such people, which in my view would be a better idea, so that at least with respect to a first offense, they are not convicted of anything, they're not arrested, they're not charged, they're not on the record. If we can't do that, then, dear God, we have an obligation to make sure that their rights are preserved and that the adjudication of their cases is done according to the highest standards of justice, and that requires a DWI court.
All right, Mark. Thank you. Is there anybody that who has an opposite view or a different view? Because what I'd like to do is to get some closure on this or any related issues pertaining to this, and I want to have enough time to explore the issue of district attorney policies and promulgation since Gwen is here. So, Glenn.
I'm very much in favor of this, but there is some opposition by the magistrates. But it's not universal. A good number of the magistrates are perfectly happy with seeing the DWI cases go. And it's not just to lessen their work, but some of the arguments that have been raised before about how consolidating this would actually be beneficial, more efficient. So I strongly am in favor of it, but I don't think we should be blind to the fact that there is going to be some opposition to any divestiture of jurisdiction in some of the town.
Sure. Well, and it happened with IDV. I mean, city court, we lose cases.
Right.
To misdemeanor domestic violence cases, we're divested of. I have to tell you, when we've got 120 cases on a Wednesday and Friday, and my clerk turns to me and says, oh, IDV court wants this case, I am not upset. I am not upset to be told that there's a case being transferred out so I can concentrate. So that gives me more time to concentrate on other cases. So I
have the same reaction. Don't throw me into that briar patch, you know?
Right. How about anybody else? Jason, Liz, are we all in agreement on this?
Yeah.
Even if it's not cost neutral, that's the real issue.
We're talking about creation of a DWI policy. A separate question is recommending that we seek another county court judge.
I think that's part and parcel of the recommendation. That's the only way it's going to work. I think you have correctly stated and argued that it has to be a county judge wearing the acting Supreme Court hat. Otherwise, a Supreme Court judge becomes diluted because they end up being spread around the entire district. So we don't want that. A city court judge cannot do it because by law, an acting Supreme must be a county judge, at least with 2 years' experience.
Unless you're a city court judge in New York City, there is a...
Okay, but we're not, so there we go. So
Kansas.
Yes, Liz.
I would just say that cost neutral, there's among towns and villages, there's quite a lot of, and counties, there's quite a lot of resentment towards the state of how much of their mandates are being paid for at the local level. So shifting some of the burden to the state, I don't think is going to meet a lot of resistance.
That's a point well made. Good.
Here.
Right.
All right. The other issue, let me just make sure I had one other point I wanted to raise about this.
We're talking about, I didn't want to
go ahead.
Define all of the different sections for this initial draft, but we're, to be clear, we're talking about, and I think Gwen is not here at the moment, DWAI's 1192.1's non-criminal violations would be transferred. We're also talking about drug driving,
yes,
which is 1192.4. So that, I just want to make sure we were clear that that was part of this DWI.
Yes, and I put that in, you'll see.
Oh, you did?
In a footnote, I made that very clear. It's all Article 31 alcohol-related offenses, including 1192s. And so I refer to it as drugs as well. It's all there. All right, the last area that I would like to discuss, at least the last area, is the question of what we've been routinely calling policies. And again, this would now not fall into a mandatory. This falls into the recommended, where we're going to be relying on the goodwill of frankly, the people who control those particular issues. In this particular one, there is one issue that we have talked about, and Gwen, you weren't here the last time when we discussed this, the whole question of coming up with a system of published policies that people could simply go to the website. They would know with all the language that would be protective, that would say, look, this isn't binding on the courts. However, these are my policies as district attorney.
Other than the ones that are up there now.
And I haven't looked recently, so tell me what's up there now.
Well, all traffic tickets are up.
All traffic tickets is posted now?
You go to the DWI website, there's a sidebar down the left-hand side that says traffic tickets.
Okay.
And it talks about how to get a reduction. There isn't any policy published with respect to penal law misdemeanors. That's sort of case by case.
There's nothing published in it. Okay.
No, not on penal law misdemeanors.
Is there a policy on the DWIs published?
No.
That'd be a tough...
That's a tough policy to draft. Usually, my position with my ADAs is if the proof doesn't support a DWAI, don't offer a DWAI. If there's problems with proof, offer a DWAI. If it is a DWAI, offer a DWAI.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last. If it is a
DWAI. If it is a DWAI, we offer a
DWAI.
You offer
the AI.
We do not offer a non-1192. Unless we have problems of proof or we lose, lose some part of the suppression hearing or it looks shaky.
Right, so there's that
we
issue.
We have offered reckless driving.
What about the issue of, and I don't want to put you on the spot at all, I'm just curious.
No, it's all right.
You know, the common wisdom is in many counties is if it's a 0.13 or above, you can't get a reduction to it.
As an office policy, but not something I feel like putting on my web page. If it's a, used to be a 0.12, now it must be probably a 0.10. I'd have to look. It's been a while since I've looked at them. That will.
I think it's a 0.11 or
yeah, because it's plus or minus. The data master is plus or minus.
0.11 or below first offense.
DWAI
is the offer if there is no aggravating
As long as no one's injured, it's a first offense, and I think that's it.
Been experimenting in city court, and this is what's nice about a DWI part, where you can actually try out something globally with a lot of DWI cases. And I think it's worked when, where you have a first offender that now is over the line of death.
Over the 0.11.
You have a 0.12s and 0.13s, and your ADAs are now turning to the defense counsel and defendant saying, well, you know what, it's a first offense, no accident, you cooperated, but you're over the 0.11, and they make an alternative offer of, you can plead guilty to a misdemeanor, have a permanent criminal record and all the ignition interlock and all the other parade of horribles that come along with it, or, you know what, based upon what your defense attorney is presenting and because you're 0.12 or 0.13, we'll offer the reduction, but you have to do some local jail time. So that's been experimented with. Pretty, and frankly, we haven't had one repeat person.
I know.
What's the attraction of the local jail time?
Well, the attraction is a lot of defendants don't want the conviction. Anybody who's a pilot would rather do a few days in jail than have an alcohol-related offense. There are many, many people. I had Peter Gerstenzang in my office fighting with me about this. He came down on the other side, but he thought it was when he was pushing me to give his client a DWAI, and there was clearly no reason to do it, and the BAC was over 0.12. I said, well, I'll tell you what, if they'll do 5 days in jail, I'll give them a DWAI. And I did it more to see, because I thought it was puffery, and sure enough, he just went insane and walked out.
Well, that's, I mean, candidly, it...
But people do take it.
They take it because they have no other choice, but it seems to me that if we're... I'm just going to speak strictly as a practical, let's save money kind of thing. It seems to me that there are lots of other equivalents to 5 days in jail that would exact society's retribution, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, maybe a huge community service obligation.
Yeah, you want to deter. I'm not focused on the retribution as I am on the deterrence. I want people, you know, you all know my history. I spent years drinking alcohol, way too much alcohol. And it was a huge deterrent in the crowd of people that I ran with. To get busted for DWI. Now, in the 70s, nothing really happened to you. But now, I still frequent local watering holes where people go after work. And it is huge. They are very afraid of DWI because of the onerous consequences, both financial and, although you can get a conditional license so you can drive to work, I mean, you know, you can't.
I mean, we're kind of getting off track, but I still don't understand why, you know, 200 hours of community service or you know, some huge amount of community service. Why wouldn't that be just as onerous and a deterrent as, you know, 5 days in jail, which becomes three?
Well,
I think this is really a district attorney's discretion on how to prosecute. I'm not sure that this is really part of...
Well,
I don't
my
think
point.
Part of our charge, I think.
I agree with that, but what I'm trying to get at is the publishing. What I'm trying to get at is candidly, and you all know, I'm kind of moving in the direction of, you know, the black box of justice, and which I've referred to many times. It seems to me, and I hate to put myself out of business, but it seems to me that people who are charged with manageable crimes ought to be able to, and violations and what have you, ought to be able to resolve those things in a way that is fair, equitable, predictable, and without, and inexpensively, without having to hire lawyers and what have you if necessary. So if the policies are published and it's a first offense, there's no aggravating circumstance, there's...
No matter what the BAC is?
No. I'm saying, in other words, if they know that it's a 0.11 or below and there's no aggravating circumstance, it's a first offense, the reduction is going to be an AI, then they ought to be able to just go into court and say, fine, I'm wrong. I plead guilty to DWAI, and and proceed, do whatever it is that has to be done.
There is something to be said for that first-time offender with a DWI that we're hoping never gets another one, that never hurts anyone, never runs over a child. That they're, the fact that they can't just go to a cookie cutter, well, what will the result be? But the fear of the unknown and having to hire a Sherpa, someone to shepherd them through the process, creates an added layer of mystery, which creates another layer of deterrence that they need someone to get them through this process. And it's tough to computerize that and just, mm-hmm. you know, with DWIs, I really believe that, punching someone in the face early on, initially, where they just get a bloody nose and they remember that punch in the face is so much better than just keeping your hand on that burner with the heat slowly being turned up, and then you don't notice that you have third-degree burns. And DWIs, where someone's never had a criminal record, just that quick wake-up call where you don't have a lifelong criminal record, it's so powerful. Maybe if 1 out of 10 people don't have a repeat offense, you're saving a life. And a judge has to be involved in that, the conversations with the defendants who don't show up to the victim impact panel. And I have to send out, I sign bench warrants for people's arrest immediately the next morning when they don't show up for a victim impact panel, and they have to have a conversation with me. So DWI, it's such a special breed of cases that I just don't think we can ever put it into that black box that you call it. So
maybe the district attorney's office, in the fullness of time, would consider a community service requirement that placed people who were getting a break at the disposal of the diversion program to provide free labor for that program, particularly in relation to addiction issues, because everybody who gets a DWI has done something which is definitionally addiction. They have used a substance and gotten in trouble as a consequence. Just maybe in the fullness of time, the office might think about that. Like 400 hours of service.
Well, let's carve DWI out of this discussion for a moment and just focus on like VNT and stuff. So that's already comprehensively there?
Well, yeah, I think so. My tablet is dead, so I didn't bring it. I can't check right now, but I checked when I got the email from Joe, and there was pretty explicit instructions of how to deal with a traffic ticket. Now, remember, I can't say you will get a one-level reduction, because a lot of the judges don't go along with it. I think one of them is here. And so I can't say this is a certain outcome. I just say this is what my policy is.
So, and that's fair. And I think Glenn has already made clear to us that would be unethical for any judge to commit to that.
Right.
And we understand that and I accept that. I'm just trying to figure out ways to streamline, to render the process more efficient.
Take a look at my website.
And I will do that.
And then give me feedback.
All right. Are there other issues that we haven't discussed? I've kind of gone through everything.
I want to raise one again. It's very brief and it's short and it's
sure.
easy.
Go ahead.
It's whether or not defense attorneys get a copy of their clients' criminal history.
Right. And I think we've agreed that that's going to be...
We've agreed that it's going to be a recommendation.
Right.
But there is a disagreement at the table as to whether there's any impediment to it at all. Glenn is of the impression, and Glenn will speak for himself, but Glenn is of the impression that under federal regulation, there is some impediment to the dissemination of this material. And the district attorney is of the opinion that under the New York criminal procedure law, it should be provided to defense counsel. And I think we ought to resolve that between now and the final version of our draft. And if, in fact, under New York law, it is mandatory, we ought to say it's mandatory, it doesn't happen, it should happen, and let the feds come in and challenge us.
Okay.
Glenn, do you have something you could share on that, or what?
Mark asked me about this by email or something, and I did a quick search, and the only thing I came up with quickly was some federal regulation, maybe. But I'll check at the Resource Center and see what the basis of this is, because it is hammered into us. And I've had police officers do the same thing. They come in, they'd have the rap sheet. I could look at it, the defense attorney could look at it, but nobody was allowed to Xerox it. And it made no sense to me.
We give it out under, as Gwen said, 16040.
Since your caseload is larger, Glenn will adopt your position.
Well, it's just the statute. I mean, we're required to give it out. It says fingerprinting, transmission of report received by police.
Yeah, I move that the chair and Glenn, Scott, work through this and come to a final position. I don't want to leave it hanging out there in our.
We have to. I'll just draw it up. What town and village courts have to give it to defense counsel, or if it's a pro se defendant, to the defendant. You get a copy of it. 160.40 subdivision 2.
All right.
Thank you.
And I'll check with the Resource Center and see if they can tell me what has been the source of this prohibition that keeps getting
that would be helpful.
Preached to us.
And then I'll write it up and just send it to you.
Sure. And then, but let's incorporate, if there is a federal contrary position, we need to figure out if we can distinguish that in some fashion. All right.
Thank you.
Are there any other issues that we wanted to discuss that we haven't discussed? I think we've covered them all, but if there's anything left, in other words, in the laundry list that Glenn had put up, we've kind of gone through them. To the extent that perhaps we haven't discussed something or we haven't discussed all of the nuances, then I think it would behoove us, when we read through and when we write and read through the report, and specifically these particular items, that we look carefully at the language and make sure that that we're all in agreement on that language. I do anticipate, one final point, I do anticipate that in Section 4, the future, that there will be some disagreement about the arc of where we should go. And what I would like is for the report to pretty much say, look, there is disagreement. These are the different positions, but I want to put it in there because I think it would be helpful as, some people down the road will say, look, the committee discussed this, they thought about this, and clearly there was some support for that, and there clearly was opposition to this, and et cetera. But I'd like that to be in there. So I'm hoping that it will be a section that will read along the lines of, we all agree to disagree with, that this is a fair statement of these particular positions in a way that allows at least those positions to be set forth in the report. So I'll do my best to write, that and to write it clearly and fairly. But obviously, everybody knows my bias in that regard. So, yes, Liz.
If the majority of us agree on a recommendation, but there is a minority that has a different opinion, will we put it as this is recommended, however, not unanimously? Or, I mean, it seems like if the majority feels strongly about going one direction, it seems like I don't think we should hesitate to make that recommendation, but be clear that there are some people that have other opinions on
about
it.
This. Yeah? When we have what is the the penultimate draft, anyone who wants their disagreement to be noted with a particular provision ought to have the opportunity to have an asterisk put in and footnote, so-and-so disagrees.
Right. And I think that's fair. We'll figure out that language later. I would ask, though, that I'm hoping that we will be able to craft language with respect to the individual, in other words, the Section 3 items, because we've all voted or taken an assessment with respect to the Section 3 items. I would hope that we don't reflect a lot of dissent there. The future, that I can see where that would happen. But yes, Liz, I think clearly if the majority say this, but there are two or three people that say that, I think that can be reflected in the language. All right, so I know, Jason, are you going to be able to get something to me with respect to what you were putting together fairly soon?
Oh,
you did? I'm sorry. I'll go back and look for that. I apologize. Yeah. No, I mean, I'm sure it's my mistake, but I'll look for it. But we'll talk then. And I think otherwise, and
I'll do lead.
You're going to do the lead thing.
I'll do lead. And as soon as I can.
Okay. So I think here's where we're at. For the next meeting, we're scheduled for I think the June 13th. I was hoping that we would have a reasonably complete draft so that we can just kind of go through it and start picking at it and at that meeting. So we're scheduled for the 13th, which I believe is a Tuesday.
Monday.
No, I think we're scheduled for the 14th.
I had the 14th.
14th, yeah. Excuse me.
Flag Day.
Flag Day, that's right. So it's Tuesday the 14th. There are some people that, is everybody here able to make it? 4:30.
I think we were talking about maybe doing it at 4 o'clock.
Oh, yeah, we were going to start at 4. That's right.
Yeah.
Tuesday the 14th, starting at 4 p.m. Everybody here can make it?
I think so.
That'd be great. Perfect. All right. So let's, final task, meeting assessment. Have we added value today? Liz, we'll just start with you.
Always. And I'm glad the LEAD program was brought up. It's interesting to hear about that.
Great. Gwen?
Yes, for all the reasons Liz said, and just because we had some important conversation.
Yeah. Mark?
Yes.
Yeah, and I very much appreciate the fact that we all hang in there, and we are civil, and we are smart, and we share our wisdom in a perceptive and insightful way. So thank you very much for all your work.